Hey everybody, welcome to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I will be your host for the next hour or so. Such a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for joining. I want to say something about today's episode because it ties into what I was talking about a week ago. If you heard the show last week, you know that I talked about the tech oligarchs. Some of them are now, some people are now calling them broligarchs because they are tech bros that are now oligarchs. These are the guys who are the CEOs. There's a chairman or a founder in there as well who were at the recent inauguration and combined all of the broligarchs at the inauguration, I think, have a net worth that exceeds $1 trillion. And so I, in that episode, I took an hour to give you my thoughts on who these guys are, what we can expect of them, and why we should think of our system now as an oligarchy. Well, to extend that thinking, I want to propose that we explore the idea of oligarchs with a comparison in today's show, and that is to look at these tech oligarchs as comic book supervillains. If you'll just permit me to work with this. I mean, if you think about some of the headlines that we have seen in just in the last week, what a certain oligarch who is closely aligned with the current occupant of the White House has been doing, taking over different institutions and gaining access to the very intimate details of government. And I'm not going to get that. That's not what the show is about. Maybe I'll do another show about those headlines. But if you look at that kind of behavior and the shamelessness and the arrogance and the intent to just to self-aggrandize in a not just a national but a global takeover, that just is right out of the comic books. I remember when I was a kid, and I forget, it was one, I should have looked this up, but it's in the 1980s when that first Superman movie came out, and Lex Luthor was the villain. Do you remember that? When Lex Luthor was the main supervillain who was opposing Superman, and he was just all of those same qualities, the ego and the overreach and the aim to take over global systems. It happens again and again. And now we're actually seeing it play out in front of us. Well, I wanted to have a conversation about the broligarchs as supervillains. And here's how this is going to work, because I've got three guests. I have three guests. Usually I have one guest on the show. Sometimes I have two. This time I have three. And I'm going to tell you about the three guests and wait for it, because you're going to hear why they are all connected to each other and to this topic. Our first guest of the three is Greg Epstein, who is the humanist chaplain at MIT and Harvard. And he has come out with a new book called Tech Agnostic: How Technology Became the World's Most Powerful Religion and Why It Desperately Needs a Reformation. I really enjoyed this book. There was just one chapter that covered tech bros as supervillains, but I read the entire book, and I would recommend it if you are interested in exploring this idea of tech as religion. You might think, why does an author about tech as religion connect to a show about tech bros as supervillains? Well, you'll hear in the interview, but these supervillains, the way they arrogate themselves is, in a way, they are assuming almost godlike roles. And in some cases, they are trying to take on near divine, in their minds, near divine status in the world. And so, as I said, one chapter in Greg's book, Tech Agnostic, covers this idea of supervillains. It's a chapter on apocalypse, which is very interesting. And inside that chapter, Greg profiles and interviews two other people who are the other two guests. Chris Gilliard, who is a surveillance scholar who has been on Tectonic a number of times in the past. As you'll hear in the interview, he lives in the Detroit area, and that's where Greg met him to talk about apocalypse and supervillains and so on. And then our third guest, also from the Detroit area, is Jim Starlin, who is a really well-known comic book artist and author and creator for decades now. And one of the creations that Jim Starlin is really well known for is Thanos, who is the ultimate supervillain. If you've seen any of the Marvel movies, you know this. Or if you've read any of Jim Starlin's comic books where he introduced and developed this character of Thanos, you know all about this. So we're going to be speaking with Greg Epstein, Chris Gilliard, and Jim Starlin about tech bros as oligarchs and as supervillains. And if you want links to Greg's book and other things that we're talking about during the interview, go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Click the playlist link for this supervillains episode, and you can get all of those details. Let's go ahead and listen now to my interview with Greg, Chris, and Jim here on Tectonic. Greg Epstein, Chris Gilliard, and Jim Starlin, welcome to Tectonic.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us.
I'm excited to have all three of you on the show together. Each of you would be a star guest on the show individually. And Chris, you've been on the show a number of times. But here we are together, so let me introduce each of you, and I'll explain what we're covering today for the listeners. Greg Epstein, you're the humanist chaplain at MIT and Harvard, and your newest book just came out. It's called Tech Agnostic: How Technology Became the World's Most Powerful Religion and Why It Desperately Needs a Reformation. It's published by MIT Press, and I'll say more about the book in a moment. Chris Gilliard, you're a surveillance scholar working on your upcoming book, Luxury Surveillance: How Big Tech Sells Us the Pleasure of Being Watched, and that's also to be published by MIT Press. And finally, Jim Starlin, you're a legendary comic book writer and artist who needs no introduction to comic book fans, but I'll just mention that you're the creator of Thanos and other Marvel characters like Adam Warlock, as well as the Dreadstar comic book series. You've also written for DC Comics on characters like Batman and the Joker and others. So what a privilege it is to have all three of you on the show. So the topic today is supervillains and the way big tech leaders are playing into every tired cliche of that genre. Chris, maybe we can start with you. What's the kind of behavior we see in the tech headlines that makes you think of supervillains?
Wow. Where to begin? Hidden bases, you know, launching rockets to the moon, wearing $900,000 watches as you talk about how you plan to allow hate speech on your platform. I mean, we could go on and on, you know. Part of how this group got together, I think, is Greg noticed my running joke on what was then Twitter, that at some point I was going to write a book called The Illustrated Guide to Silicon Valley Supervillains. And on my Twitter account, I cataloged a variety of ways I thought that there was sort of villainous behavior afoot. So, yeah, there's a long list.
And how is that Illustrated Guide to Supervillains coming along? Or did you shelve that for Luxury Surveillance?
I mean, I shelved it. I'm still collecting examples, of which there are many. You know, I think we've gotten to the Lex Luthor is now president version of it.
That's the first thing that came to my mind when we started talking.
I think we've got enough examples. That part. But yeah, I'm still collecting.
Greg, can you talk us a little more through this idea of supervillains and how that fits into this larger idea of tech as religion, which I think you argue very persuasively in this book?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the book overall argues that tech, Silicon Valley tech, not just all technology, but contemporary Silicon Valley tech has effectively become the world's most powerful religion today. And I say that as somebody where I've been studying religion professionally for, you know, 25 or so years. And it desperately needs a reformation, meaning, you know, I'm not saying I'm against all tech or against anything and everything that Silicon Valley does or ever did. I'm just saying that it's desperately in need of an ability to self-reflect, to be self-critical, to improve itself, to listen to critics who say it's prioritizing itself and its own success rather than you know, humanity itself. So essentially, I think that the best way to frame this at the beginning is just to say that tech has a theology, it has a doctrine, it has hierarchies, not quite a caste system, I didn't want to say in the book, but hierarchies, very much like traditional religions do. It has enormous numbers of rituals, you know, the way that we genuflect before our stained glass black mirror altars a couple hundred times a day, you know, more than any other religion asks us to pray. And unlike many other religions that I could mention, this one actually seems to me to have the real potential to cause an apocalypse. And I was reflecting on that in a number of ways. I really wanted to talk to Chris Gilliard about it. It was something where, like, if I could just talk to Chris about this topic, that to me would be the best way that I could possibly, you know, get at this subject matter, express it in a book. And Chris, of course, you know, he's hyper visible. He doesn't want to talk to people like me. You know, he's busy. He doesn't want to be photographed. He doesn't want, you know, and so it's like thinking, how could I get Chris Gilliard, who I don't know well, to talk to me? And I said to him at one point, okay, what if I arrange a meeting between you and I and Jim Starlin? Like, if I fly out to Detroit and you and I can talk to Jim Starlin together, would you actually let me talk to you then? Could we spend some time together then? And he said, okay, I guess. But I didn't know Jim Starlin at that point.
I'm the bride, hey? I didn't realize.
So then I set out on a bit of a quest to try to figure out how to, you know, meet Jim Starlin and get him to talk to us. And here we are a couple years later, and I'm thrilled. I really am honored.
And what inspired you to include Jim Starlin as the inducement for Chris? I know that Jim's work speaks for itself and his work says a lot about villains and heroes and apocalypses, but what specifically in Starlin's portfolio of work were you thinking of?
Well, I know Jim's work quite a bit, not anywhere near as well as Chris, who could probably have done a PhD on it. But, you know, to me, he's certainly the creator of Thanos, one of the most interesting comic book characters in of all time, maybe the greatest supervillain of all time. I mean, how amazing is that, the idea that you try to kill half the world to impress death, to win her love? Like, it's just so psychologically.
I've done worse.
You know, so anyway, it was this idea of Silicon Valley supervillains. Now, you know, if you read Jim's work and that of the best of his colleagues as well, supervillains are complex, just like the heroes, right? Like, they're not all evil. They've got some almost redeeming qualities. They're flawed, so deeply flawed, but like, they're interesting to think about. And they come from, you know, real experiences, real history, real people. And so when I heard about Chris's idea of Silicon Valley supervillains, right, it's like, yes, these people are amassing. And I'm talking about Silicon Valley CEOs and leaders, venture capitalists, et cetera. They're amassing so much power, so much influence over what it means for any of us to be human today. And they're doing that both because of and through the means of like really strange ideas and practices that I'm searching for a term for. And it's like, I'm not calling them the gods. They're trying to project gods onto the universe. They're trying to like make us believe in gods. But they themselves aren't really gods to me. What are they? They're like these super villains. That's what they are. And so Chris just captured it beautifully on Twitter, like his Twitter RIP, now his blue sky. To me, it's one of the most interesting, insightful social media accounts that I've ever seen. And, you know, it's because of this idea. And so I just kind of picked up from that and from our phone conversations that, like, this would be the way to go. And it was, and it worked out amazingly.
And I would agree that Chris's social media feed is a must read for anybody who's interested in the topics I talk about in Tectonic. In fact, I get a lot of my news stories that I read out to listeners from Chris's feed, and you can get it at Hypervisible. And I'll put a link to that on the playlist. Let me read this one post on Twitter from a few years ago, Greg, that you quoted in your book, Tech Agnostic. Chris wrote, "It's like the evil sci-fi villain checklist. Facilitate global destruction? Check. Develop plan to escape Earth? Check. Invest in immortality schemes so you can be a colonizer forever? Check." I thought that exemplified this idea very well about the tech CEOs, as you say, Greg, not presuming to be gods exactly, but setting themselves up as these all-powerful forces that really resemble supervillains. Jim, I wanted to ask you, you're the creator of Thanos, as Greg says, maybe the greatest supervillain in pop culture. What is your thought process as you begin to develop the idea for a supervillain? What are the elements, the backstory, the motivations? What goes into inventing a good supervillain?
Basically, you start off with a cliche, and then you start looking for the contradictions. And these particular supervillains we're talking about, as soon as we started the conversation, I was remembering when the personal computers first started and with Photoshop came in, and it became kind of a religion to us people who were getting in on that at this point. I remember talking to a writer, Ann Nocenti, who accused me of having a religious fervor over this whole computer thing. The difference between the kind of villains that I write and kind of villains that we are talking about here today are that we, the users, are the ones who are giving it its power, giving them their power. We're the ones who go onto Facebook and onto Twitter and all these things. We're buying things on Amazon rather than going down to the corner store. We are, in effect, creating our own Uber lords for us to be ruled over by down the line. So I'd say that your classic villain is more self-made, and your tech villain is more a product of society itself. Mm.
That's an interesting distinction. Did you ever write a villain who drew power from the people he was affecting?
No, but not that I can think of, but there was a Iron Man villain called the Controller who would take people and put little discs on their heads, and he became stronger each time he got another person added to his link. So that's pretty much how high tech works in the same way.
I mean, it occurs to me, though, that like there are instances where villains are able to persuade people that they're acting in their own interest to follow the villain, right? I mean, the Mad Hatter comes to mind. I think there have been some Joker storylines about that. But it's also a thing in the history of false messianism, basically. I mean, in one of the early chapters, sort of leading up to the chapter that features all of us here, I tell the story of a messianic figure named Shabtai Tzvi, who was the leading false messiah in the history of Judaism. Got the majority of the world's Jews to believe in him, to worship him, to take their biggest fast day, Yom Kippur, and turn it into a feast day. And ultimately, the Sultan, the Ottoman Sultan, called him in and said, like, you're going to convert or die. Which one is it going to be? And he converts and, you know, spends the rest of his day as like the doorman to the doorman of the Sultan. Yeah, it's just interesting to think, like, how ingenious of a villain do you have to want to be God in such a way that you're able to persuade people to almost treat you as such? So, I mean, Chris, what do you make of the fact that when we sat down to interview Jim, you know, this couple of years ago, we had just spent quite a bit of time, like, kind of complaining, commiserating together about everything that you write and tweet and skeet about so eloquently. And Jim presented us with a more, I would say, ambivalent perspective. It was eloquent, to be sure. Well, it's not a critique of it in any way, but it was sort of encouraging us. I took it as to lean into our ambivalence about this, to think about how, you know, technology has its benefits as well. Even Silicon Valley tech, it helped him as an artist, et cetera, right? What do you make of that? You know, what are you feeling about that kind of message these days?
Yeah, I guess the way I would think about it or talk about it is, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about Luddism, you know, Brian Merchant's book, and whether or not when we critique these things, you know, we might be adequately named as Luddites in the pejorative way that it's gained traction. And I think, like a lot of people, I mean, I love technology. You know, I've been an early adopter of so many different things. I mean, I think it goes without saying that we wouldn't have this grouping right now if not for some of the technology that's available to us. But I'll take a specific thing. If we think about Facebook or Meta, you know, kind of the revisionist history aside about how it came into existence, the thing they have privileged forever and ever is connection. And they say that we exist to connect people. And I think where that went wrong, what gets missed in that is that you are connecting families to their relatives overseas. You are connecting grandparents to their grandchildren. You are connecting people with, you know, scholars that they may otherwise not have been had access to. But you're also connecting hate groups, and you're also connecting fascists, and you're also connecting people who are vested in causing or creating or facilitating genocide. I think that that's sort of the part, like, it doesn't have to be that way. All of those ways that connection has, those connections have come to be, are the result of some pretty conscious choices that these folks have made, and they could have made very different choices. And that's where my sort of villain articulation comes in. You know, and just to sort of piggyback to Jim, I mean, the reason that the Jim part was so appealing to me is I had been such a longtime fan of his. One of the things I thought was so amazing about his work is the way that he created the complex villains, right? So we've talked about Thanos, but right, I Dreadstar is a series that holds such like a place in my heart. And I still remember reading, he wrote a story about this villain, the Lord High Papal, and like how he came, how this villain sort of came up as a child. Part of what happened is that he was subject to such extreme prejudice as a child. That's part of why he manifested as a villain. I read this a long time ago, and I still remember it so clearly. So I knew that about Jim before we met him, and so that is part of what has always drawn me to his work.
Contradiction is a big part of characterization. And I wanted you to feel a little bit sorry for the bad guy there for a bit. Not too long, but just a little bit. Tech for me has been a bit of a different path of late. Recently, I just announced I was going to use some AI in the background and stuff like that in my work. Nothing's appeared yet because I work so far ahead that it'll be at least another year before anything like that comes out. It's a minor part. It's, you know, putting some buildings in the background or, you know, what have you. But I've been taking a tremendous amount of heat about it already. I got a Google alert of somebody who writing yesterday saying that, well, Starlin's obviously a lazy artist if he's going to be using AI in it. And I'm going, okay, even with the AI, and I'll put my pages against complication, how complicated they are against most people, and I think it'll work out. But what you were talking about earlier, how some of these villains of tech didn't do anything to stop the haters from taking over. And I don't know how you can do that and have any kind of platform, because if they don't do it on Facebook, they're going to do it on another site. It's just the fact that we are such complex and really kind of screwed up species everyone comes with a sphincter and an opinion, and you just gotta live with that, unfortunately, and try and not get ground up by the bad sphincters.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Greg Epstein, Chris Gilliard, and Jim Starlin, talking about the tech oligarchs as supervillains, the kind you might find in a comic book, like the many, many comic books that Jim Starlin has written and drawn over the years. Greg, as I said in the introduction, has just come out with a new book called Tech Agnostic, which was the basis for this conversation. And Chris Gilliard is a longtime friend of the show and writes online as Hypervisible. Links to all of these resources are available at the playlist at tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm. Let's go ahead and listen now to the second half of my interview with Greg Epstein, Chris Gilliard, and Jim Starlin here on Tectonic. One of the things that's come up a couple of times as we discuss supervillains is their backstory, which, Jim, as you said, may, once you get to know them a bit, have the reader sympathizing a little bit with the supervillain. This is a thread that I detected in your book, Greg, about the backstories of some of these tech CEOs. And what I'm referring to is what you write about as the, quote, gifted child mentality. At one point in the book, you quote an AI researcher who says in an interview, "Ambitious people would rather destroy the world than never amount to anything." And I started that comment because I thought it connected very well with our discussions of supervillains. In both cases, you have individuals who are no doubt talented or smart or have some sort of impressive capability, let's say, but they have this hole in their heart and they feel like it's going to be filled if they can just feel important. And as they achieve this material success, it never quite gets filled. Well, what can you say more about the gifted child mentality and how that figures into some of these tech leaders?
Yeah, I think that that's a big part of it. And, you know, it's part of why I love the idea of Thanos doing what he does to try to win love. I tell my son, I have an 8-year-old son, and he's been sort of right by my side as I've been working on this project all these years. I like to point out to him, whenever you see a kind of supervillain type figure in any of the pop culture that he's, you know, watching, consuming, it's not unadulterated evil. It's not pure, raw, uncut evil, like, you know, as if it were the stuff that Heisenberg makes in Breaking Bad, you know, the raw drugs. It's laced through and through with this sense of desperation to conquer, to defeat, to win, that comes, I think, from an earnest and almost, you know, pretty understandable, actually, in some ways, at least to me, given my biases, my background, place of young people in American society, particularly white men, but others as well, grow up with this feeling. You know, they may come from a loving home, they may come from good, you know, sincere parents, but they're taught from the very beginning that what's good about them is what they achieve, right? So the parent will comment like, "Oh, you did so well, you won that award, you aced that test, you were better than your classmates, whatever." That reward system is on a huge feedback loop that comes to dominate our society with this idea that it's like Puritanism. You're either the elect, the elite, you're chosen by God, the universe, tech, or whatever, or you are damned to something almost as bad as the sort of fire and brimstone hell, which is mediocrity, normalness, etc. There's very little room in our popular culture, you know, unless you're, you know, coming from a very specific religious belief, to simply be a normal human and be as deserving of love and affection and dignity as anybody and everybody else. And so, you know, the villains to me are the people who kind of internalize that message and say, I am determined, because I think this is a virtuous system, I am determined to do everything I possibly can to achieve that status or to demonstrate that I'm of that status of the elect. And I think that's what, you know, that's what makes Jim's characters and characters like them so powerful. It's like, it's just the pursuit of this thing that we're told we ought to pursue anyway, but at an extreme degree.
That's what I wanted to say, is the fact that it is a matter of degree. I mean, we have three writers here on this panel. We all three think we have something to say that people are going to want to hear. That's a bit of sociopathic in sense all by itself. I think your villain is the one who doesn't know when to stop. The psychopath comes into the mixture, and the end goal has to be reached by any means. We do it ourselves in our writing, I'm sure, to a limited degree. We sacrifice something in a personal relationship in order to get this job done, or so on and so forth. So I think your villain is the one who just doesn't have any breaks.
I would add to that. I mean, we've seen that a lot recently with sort of tech CEOs and their, you know, public heel turn. Like, I'll say from the outset, I don't accept this narrative, but their story about themselves is that they didn't receive the adulation they thought they were due, and this is why they've turned heel. We've seen this over and over again with a variety of these folks that, you know, I thought if I did X, Y, and Z, that I would not only get rich, but everyone would love me. And now I'm rich, but everyone doesn't love me. And so now I've got to become evil. So, yeah,
I mean, there really is the story that you see with like Zuckerberg now and Elon Musk. Like, they're changing some really fundamental aspects. Chris, you know, one of the things that I see in your work is, if people, as Jim just said, are not able to put the brakes on, and I really would agree with that characterization as describing a lot of these Silicon Valley leaders. Somebody like you, I see you as like, well, you're going to have to get them to put the brakes on, or, you know, like somebody's got to apply the brakes if they won't. And that's one of the things that I see you trying to do. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty dire time, to be honest. Wow, I almost don't know how to answer that. I mean, I think that is an important aspect of it, right? Like, that there are so many of these things that, again, if we could have them in ways that didn't also bring, not so simply as if we could only have the good, right? But if we could have some of these things that didn't also bring about to some of the more cataclysmic options, right? Like, if we think about chatbots and large language models and things like that, you know, they've been pitched as everything from like therapist to teacher to doctor to partner, you know, girlfriend, boyfriend. And I'll reluctantly admit that if they hadn't been pitched as the everything, that there's a possibility that they would have, you know, I'd be more sort of open to how we might use them. But the other thing is that there's the theft aspect of them. There's the environmental aspect. There's the way that almost with glee, a lot of people who promoting these tools, almost with glee, they talk about the ability to put artists and writers out of jobs. And so, yeah, I think that those breaks are important. I wonder, or I always think of, like, how could we change the equation in terms of what affordances or what allowances or what benefits we have from these? Because we're always told that we have to take not only sort of the good with the bad, but we have to, like, take all of the bad if we want any of the good. And I mean, yeah, it's so important to try and change that equation.
Jim, in your many storylines that you've written, Have you ever written about a villain who is permanently disposed of?
Well, I did a lot of work for Marvel, and those become corporate assets, so they don't die off. But basically, no, the only one I ever killed off to stay dead was a good guy, Captain Marvel. So that doesn't say much. That's kind of pessimistic toward what the future looks like, isn't it? Okay.
There's a Dreadstar story where the Universal War is won, I guess, by the destruction of the universe. You know,
yeah, the Metamorphosis Odyssey. And I am planning on killing off permanently a bad guy here in the near future. In fact, that's the whole story idea, is being a good death.
Oh, wow. We're getting scoops here.
Well, quickly plug the Dreadstar then. Monkey Wrench Press, we're going to be doing a Kickstarter for the third book, Dreadstar versus Dreadstar, shortly. As far as AI goes, I was just talking to another artist recently who he said, somebody else at the table said, aren't you afraid that the AI is going to replace you? And he turned to this person and said, no, it's going to be an artist who's using an AI that's going to replace me. It's just another tool now, as far as I see. Basically, I've got it just for doing backgrounds and stuff like that. And like I said, I've gotten a little heat from it, but I still think I come from Detroit. We brought the car into existence and all the buggy whips went out of business. Things evolve and there's always a change. And hopefully we'll survive this change too. But one thing I have learned from dealing with what I have with the AI so far is that it's the most unimaginative thing that you've ever wanted to deal with. You ask it to do a doorway, it'll give you the simplest doorway. There'll be no style to it. There'll be no intrigue or mystery to it. And let's say they create an algorithm that actually can do creative talent and thinking, which I don't see happening anytime real soon. I think we're fairly safe on the entertainment front in the fact that we're still going to need people to tell the dumb AI what we want and how to make it interesting. Because on its own, it's pretty unimaginative.
I mean, my take on this has consistently been that when we talk about whether or not these things can produce poems or make movies or write stories or things like that, in addition to what Jim said, I just don't think it's the right question. I mean, earlier in the podcast, I mentioned, you know, a story I read in high school or something that still sticks with me. And, you know, knowing Jim was from Detroit and having that connection, right, that there's so much about connecting to art is an attempt to get like the connect with the artist, right? To have some insight into what they were thinking or feeling or what they wanted you to think or feel across time and space, right? It's kind of a magical thing. And whether or not a computer or some kind of program can mimic that, it doesn't have a perspective. You know, there's not a way, for me anyway, right? I can't really speak to how other people connect with art. But to me, that lack of a perspective renders it kind of meaningless to me. And so I think that that's when we sometimes talk about this, that gets lost, is that these systems don't have a perspective or insight that we're connecting to in the way that we connect to art traditionally.
It doesn't have the facets that a human mind has. That's why I'm not too worried about it on the creative front. Military, another matter, but you know, on the creative front, I'm feeling pretty secure at the moment.
Maybe as a final topic for us to discuss in the last few minutes, I wanted to bring up the idea of how we fight back against some of these supervillains. Greg, you brought this up explicitly in the book. You write, how does one fight the sort of villain whose superpower is the granting of success and prestige at the expense of others? It's a difficult question, right? These guys, most of them are guys, have incredible material wealth, power, influence, now very real political influence. And you write about some of the, in a chapter about apostates and heretics, which I enjoyed a lot. You write about some of the people like Chris who are speaking out against these injustices, but it's difficult work. It's really hard to fight against these forces that are so much better armed. What are some of your thoughts, Greg, about how those of us who are concerned about the trajectory we're on should go about fighting back?
Well, to fight back, I want people to keep in mind a couple of the insights that came to me that, you know, that I was left with at the end of writing this chapter on tech apocalypses, which is really my favorite chapter in my own book. I mean, there are others that I would recommend to other people for different purposes, but this chapter is sort of a microcosm of why I wanted to spend 6 years on this book in the first place. And first, I'll say, at the end of the day, at the end of the chapter, the crime that I'm suggesting most of tech's supervillains, if you will, be convicted of is it's not first degree murder. It's involuntary manslaughter. It's carelessness with human life and well-being. And involuntary manslaughter, you know, it's not the worst crime in the world in a literal sense, but it's also a very serious crime. And so some amount of hate for the committer of involuntary manslaughter, if that crime affects you personally, and sort of these days global, you know, these tech actions are global, they all affect us to some degree, you know, some amount of hate is warranted, along with other things like compassion, like an understanding of myself as flawed as well, you know, interconnectedness, et cetera. So it's complicated to push back against involuntary manslaughter, but that's the task ahead of us, and we have to figure out how to do it. The other thing that I want to emphasize is, you know, at the end of the chapter, I talk about friendship and, you know, something that I learned from Chris about friendship. I won't get into it all here. I'd love for people to read, but just, you know, he and I kind of had a moment together in Detroit where I was like, oh, simple human connection, something that honestly men in America often lack the ability to have, to feel, to experience, to cultivate. Simple human connection, helping another human being, loving another human being, feeling like, you know, your life is better because you're just, you know, you're willing to be vulnerable and see another person and be seen by them, is ultimately a big part of the solution. And you know, to wrap up my own comments and you know, let Chris and Jim take us out. It's so painfully ironic to me that this chapter was perhaps inspired. Like, I know Detroit pretty well through my friend Suwatu, who was the best friend at my wedding, a best man at my wedding. Sorry. I call him my best friend. You know, I'm one of his few best friends because he's better at friendship than I am. But we've known each other for 28, 29 years. And he inspired me to write this book in many ways. He kind of gave me some thoughts that led to the book. And he's from inner city Detroit, you know, not far from where Chris grew up and came of age. And long story short, I was just out in L.A., in Altadena, actually, the red line suburb near L.A., or rather the black middle class suburb where people fled to because of redlining and racism. To visit Suwatu for the umpteenth time, have our kids spend time with one another. And of course, that home that we spent time in over Christmas and New Year's is gone. Everything about it is gone. I've been organizing a GoFundMe for him. His name is Suwatu Moore for the last few days. It's all gone. It's gone because people don't know how to stop with the climate change producing technologies. It's gone because AI is making climate change and global warming worse through its intensive need for electricity and water. It's gone because, as Jim said, we don't know how to put on the brakes towards our tech apocalypse. And so that's what we're faced with. And I leave it to you to say something about, you know, what's needed from there.
Chris or Jim?
I almost want to leave it right there. But, you know, I was talking to a colleague earlier today. And, you know, I think part of how kind of money moves around and, you know, how venture capital works and things like that, I think in the last decade or so, we've started to see a little bit that businesses almost feel like they don't need consumers anymore, that the consumer is sort of tertiary to making money. What's starting to happen now, you know, and I typically avoid this term, right? But I think tech people now are starting to act as if they don't actually need users. We've seen, you know, all these companies with their synthetic users and platforms now that, regardless of whether people use them or not or want to use them, all this to say that I think part of fighting back may need to come in the form of abolition, right? Like, to remember that we had a functioning society, and one might argue functioned much better in certain ways before many of these things came along. And so that maybe one of the propositions we might consider is that we might be better off without many of these things. So yeah, that's where I'll go. I'll leave Jim with the last word.
I think what was mentioned earlier about unity is probably the solution to everything here. Not unity on a platform, but unity among individuals who are willing to listen to diverse outlooks and then help the community to come to a solution that is not destructive or self-destructive. The platforms that you're talking about, maybe where this starts, but it's going to come down to the whole of society getting tired of what has been going on and either finding a substitute or changing their own behavior so that they do not feed this beast. And I think that's the only hope we have. On that dire note, I end it.
Well, I should assure listeners that there is a lot of hope in this book, just as there were glimmers of hope in this conversation. I want to thank all three of you for being with me today, Greg Epstein, Chris Gilliard, and Jim Starlin. And again, we're discussing Greg's new book, Tech Agnostic, How Technology Became the World's Most Powerful Religion and Why It Desperately Needs a Reformation. Greg, Chris, and Jim, thanks again for being on Tectonic today.
Pleasure.
We're equally discussing Luxury Surveillance, Chris's upcoming book, and Jim's Kickstarter project. To me, it's just such a privilege to be in dialogue with both of them. And thank you so much, Mark.
This has been one hell of a mix here.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the last few minutes of the show. You just heard my interview with Greg Epstein, author of the new book, Tech Agnostic. He's also the humanist chaplain at MIT and Harvard. And we heard from surveillance scholar Chris Gilliard, who's been on the show a bunch, a friend of the show, and legendary comics artist Jim Starlin, creator of Thanos, as well as other characters. What a good discussion. I appreciate all three of those gentlemen taking time to speak with me so that I could share that conversation with all of you. I hope you enjoy that as much as I did. And again, if you want to get links to Greg's book or Chris's Hypervisible account, you can go to the playlist at tectonic.fm. TECHtonic.fm. And speaking of Tectonic, I have mentioned over the last several weeks that we are syndicating the show. There are now affiliate stations all over the country that are carrying Tectonic. And I just wanted to welcome a new station to the fold. We want to say thank you and welcome to KZZH, which is in Humboldt County, California. I think the station itself is in Eureka, California, but the signal goes out throughout Humboldt County. And KZZH is airing Tectonic on Thursday mornings at 8 a.m. local time, that's Pacific time. So welcome to everybody listening from KZZH. And if your station, if you live elsewhere in the country and you'd like your own independent non-commercial station to pick up Tectonic, just go to tectonic.fm and there's instructions, or you can email me at mark@wfmu.org, or you can email syndication@wfmu.org. This has been a kind of a milestone episode. It's a little unusual for me to have three guests, and to cover a book and villains and tie it into last week's show, and there's a lot of connections there. But it's also episode number 350 of Tectonic. I have hosted 350 episodes of this show, and what a privilege it continues to be. So thank you to everybody for continuing to listen and for your suggestions and support. It always means a lot. I wanted to also note an upcoming event. We're going to get the Tectonic community together here at WFMU downstairs in Monty Hall, our performance space in downtown Jersey City, New Jersey. And we're gonna have a movie night. This is Thursday, February 20. Okay, so Thursday, February 20. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. I'm going to be hosting, and we're going to watch a documentary called Flash Wars, Autonomous Weapons, AI, and the Future of Warfare. Again, that's Thursday, February 20, so coming right up, and doors are at 7:30, and you can sign up if you go to WFMU.org. Just scroll down, and you'll see coming up in Monty Hall, and there's a little tickets link for that. And that's Thursday, February 20. Movie night here at WFMU. We're going to all watch Flash Wars, this documentary about autonomous AI weapons, together in Monty Hall. So I hope I will see you there. Mark your calendar, buy your ticket, buy your tickets, plural, and I'll see you then. I guess I would just want to close. I have so many reactions and further thoughts about the themes of supervillains and the Broligarchs and AI and the trajectory we're on, as we talked about. But I just wanted to close with, with one quote that I've always liked. And this is picking up on something that Jim Starlin said, which is this idea that things are nuanced, and there's always contradiction in the supervillain. And Jim, as the creator of these supervillains, may even want us to have some empathy or even sympathy for the supervillains for some amount of time. And Greg Epstein picked up on this and talked about, you know, maybe we do have anger or even hate to some extent for what these Broligarchs are doing to us and our society and our community and our environment and so on. But that should be laced with compassion as well, because it's unlikely that these guys are working out of pure malice, as Greg put it, pure uncut evil. As he said, it's not first degree murder, it's involuntary manslaughter, which is a very serious charge and needs to be stopped. But it brings to mind this quote, and it comes from the classic book by Alexander Solzhenitsyn called The Gulag Archipelago, which he published in 1973 about his time in the Soviet prison system. And it's probably the most famous quote from this long book, but I've always liked this a lot. Here's what Solzhenitsyn wrote. "If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being, and who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart?" Again, that was from The Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and much to think about in that quote. And we're going to continue to explore the nuance of what's happening, but also to call out the very real evil outcomes that these Broligarchs and big tech are having on all of us, and explore ways to resist and even create technology for good. And we're going to do that on future Tectonic episodes. So thanks, friends, for sticking with me. You can find more information on the show at tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm. And until next time, friends, I have some homework for you. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And I thought we would go out this evening to a little bit of music that has to do with Jim Starlin's creation, Thanos. This is the Thanos theme by Alan Silvestri, and I think it communicates the feeling that many of us have every day now as we read these tech headlines. Don't lose heart, friends. We're going to get through this. Have a great week. Listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned for Dave Mandel.
Oh, yes. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another exciting installment of It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here right exactly at this time every Monday here at WFMU. That is 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks so much for joining me. We are going to start. I might have as many as two tributes to people who either had birthdays recently or passed away recently. And I'll only mention one of them because I'm going to play one for sure right now, and that is Robert Wyatt. A lot of people, rightly so, have done tributes of various sizes to Robert Wyatt here in the past week or so. He just turned 80, and that calls for some kind of celebration. I'm sure you agree. Robert Wyatt was, of course, an important founding member of the Canterbury scene. Can you be a member of the Canterbury scene? A founder, an important figure in the Canterbury scene. Of course, he was a member of the Soft Machine, drummer in the Soft Machine, as well as the Soft Machine spinoff, not spinoff, but follow-up, Matching Mole. Anyways, I thought it only proper to play some Robert Wyatt and sort of tip my hat to one of the founding fathers of the music, the genre that we celebrate on this show. So I'm going to play something from an early solo album of his, namely Rock Bottom. It's going to be a piece called Little Red Riding Hood Hit the Road, and it features Ed, you know, Robert Wyatt, in fact, after all that buildup, is you know, sort of on the borderline of what you would call prog, but certainly, you know, very close to the prog side of the border. And this track is proggy, but the probably the most notable thing is it features Richard Sinclair on bass, and he, of course, was a member of a few very important prog bands, Canterbury bands, namely Caravan and Hatfield in the North. So anyway, here's Robert Wyatt from the Rock Bottom album with very prominently Richard Sinclair on the bass.